Good morning, everyone. The lecture today and next week, it's a block of two lectures. We will do on the topic of theoretical foundations of compensation and benefits. So these two lectures, during today's and next week's lecture, we're going to go through the major theories, the major economic theories that explain wages, right? So what do these theories explain? The first fact that these theories explain is why wages differ. So to answer the question why wages differ, we're going to look at the supply and demand of labor on a competitive labor market. We will look at the concept of market equilibrium in its application to wages. Does competitive labor market, does the interaction between supply and demand for labor on a competitive labor market explain the differences in wage levels between different people? Well, it does to some extent, namely to the extent to which these differences are caused by differences in labor supply and demand and labor productivity between different people. That also fits the picture here. But the workings of a competitive labor market alone do not explain all, everything in wages. So we will then proceed to the one big overarching, I would say, certainly fundamental to this course, issue of the agency problem, the principal-agent relationship, which I'm sure you've all heard about from your previous courses. The central problem to the principal-agent relationship is, of course, that of the conflict of interest. The interests of the principal and the agent are not aligned. The agent wants to maximize wages, net of costs of effort. The principal wants to maximize the profit, which is output minus the wages. So the agent wants to work as lightly as possible, and the principal wants the agent to work as hard as possible. Okay, so today we're going to do labor supply and demand, maybe efficiency wages, maybe signaling and screening to the extent that this course requires. Next week we're going to look at the issue of performance-related pay. So in a sense, the next week's lecture will be the most important lecture for the theory part of the course. Now, we were talking about principal and agent. The principal wants the agent to work as hard as possible because the harder the agent works, the more money the agent's effort generates for the principal. Of course, there's an optimal level of effort, which, guess what, is never reached in a typical situation in which the principal cannot observe the agent's effort. So the agent will always try to minimize efforts to the as much as the situation allows. Now, does the situation always allow agent to minimize effort? Well, agent is certainly trying to, but what the principal can do is, well, any combination of the following three things. The principal can offer the so-called efficiency wage, which is a wage above the market equilibrium level. Why? Well, the story is, with the imperfect monitoring of effort intensity, there is a chance that the agent will be caught when the agent decides to shirk. When the agent is caught shirking, he's fired, and his next best job will pay less than the efficiency level of wage paid by the principal, so the agent wouldn't want to shirk. Now, the second thing that the principal wants to do is signaling and screening, to learn about how productive and motivated the agents really are. This is a very interesting problem in itself because, of course, agents know that the principal wants productive and motivated people, and everybody is going to say, I'm a very productive and motivated person. And there are ways to separate the liars, the cheaters, and the tellers of the genuine truth, which has to do with the procedures of signaling and screening. And finally, what the principal can do, and what the principal very often, though not always does, is relate the principal's wages, which is what the principal wants, to a certain measure of performance that the agent delivers, which is what the principal wants. So by aligning the interests of the principal and with the interests of the agent through offering performance-related pay, part of the agency problem is solved, though the agency problem will never be solved completely. Now, so let's talk about, before we get to these, I would say, more interesting issues of incentives and screening, signaling, and efficiency, let's look at a very sort of economics 101 story about a competitive labor market. So here's the basic theory of competitive labor market, which is our starting point for this course. So it assumes that everybody is the same. It's blatantly untrue. Of course, everybody's different. But to get to the very basic model on which we can build to make it more adequate, we have to start somewhere. So let's start with assuming that everybody is homogeneous, right? So it doesn't matter who is teaching compensation and benefits to you. It could be a robot. It could be someone who doesn't speak English. So that's what the competitive labor market theory assumes. Okay. So now what does the pay rate do then? Well, the different people still can get different pay rates, and the different pay rates reflect costs associated with employment. And of course, these are costs of effort on the part of the agent and the costs of wages on the part of the principal, which are base wage, incentives, etc. Okay, so guess what? The competitive labor market theory at this stage does not really distinguish between compensation in the form of cash and benefits in the in-kind compensation, which distinction will, of course, we will necessarily make in this course at a later stage. Now, the labor markets are competitive. In what sense are the labor market competitive? Right? So there are different meanings of competitive labor market. Now, the meaning of competitive labor market that's going to be helpful for us today is to say, well, a labor market is competitive in a sense that there's no advantage that firms can derive from paying higher wages than their competitors. So the labor market is competitive. I see the other firms are paying 10 euros per hour. There's no way for me to pay, let's say, 12 euros per hour. I can, but there's no point. Now, does it make sense? No. That's a basic theory of competitive labor market. It may make sense to pay 12 euros per hour when the competitors are paying 10 euros per hour. You may recall the last lecture when we were talking about CNB and strategic human resource management, and we were talking about the fit between business strategy and CNB practices. Now, it may be that different firms will have different CNB practices and as a result will pay different wages to their workers in reflection of the different business strategies that they're pursuing. But again, competitive labor market has none of it. So another thing that's characteristic of the competitive labor market theory and not characteristic of the real world is that all firms and workers have perfect information about everything. So everybody knows how productive this particular worker is. Every worker knows about how productive his colleagues are. Every worker knows about the profit structure of the firm, about the production function, that is the rule that transforms the worker's effort into the firm's profit. So there's full and perfect information asymmetry on the market. Okay. Now, under this highly unrealistic setting, there is an equilibrium wage, which is the wage that matches the demand and supply, that corresponds to the point when the labor demand and labor supply are equal. So there are exactly the number of vacancies that firms are willing to provide at this level of wage are equal exactly to the number of people who are willing to work at this wage. And this wage is called equilibrium wage, and the employment level that corresponds to this equilibrium wage is called equilibrium employment. Now, so that's how it looks like in the textbook, the picture from the textbook. Here is labor demand. It's a downward sloping line. Why? Because the more expensive the labor is, the fewer firms are willing to employ labor at such cost. The labor supply is an upward sloping line. Why? Because the higher the wage is, the more people are willing to work at this sort of wage. You can read about labor demand and supply, what are they made of, Labor demand is fundamentally the marginal productivity of labor, and labor supply is fundamentally the costs of labor, right? So the costs of working. Now, there are always more people for whom the wage, there are always more people for whom the higher wage means an adequate compensation for their costs of effort, so there'll be more people willing to work under higher wage. Now, there are always fewer people whose productivity is high enough to employ them at the higher wage. That's why the labor demand is a downward sloping line. But that's all very basic, and I will therefore just skip through it. Now, I will get straight to the point, and the point is, look here, if everybody is homogeneous, one, right? If the market is competitive, in a set, so that all firms will pay the same wage to the same set of skills and productivities, and three, if everybody knows everything, the logical implication of this theory is that for a given job, like a university professor, for instance, all wages paid by all firms should be equal. So that's the necessarily logical implication. It's like 2 + 2 = 4. And yet, if you look at the real world, you'll see that wages differ considerably, even for a very narrowly defined group of jobs. Okay? So this is a very, well, not very narrowly, but let's say sort of loosely, quite precisely defined job, food preparers. So who are food preparers? Food preparers are people who work in the mensa, who prepare food, right? So the people who prepare your food when you go to the mensa here, the people who maybe sell you the food are also would come under the heading food preparers. And this is a distribution. This is the distribution of wages for of the wages for food preparers. So the black bars on this picture can't really. So the black bars on this picture are the wages, the frequencies of people whose job is food preparer, who receive a certain level of wage. Now the gray bars are the corresponding frequencies of the all occupations. And these are the data from 2013 from the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics. So what it says about 55% of food preparers receive a wage less than $9.25 per hour. 55% of them receive, let's say, $9 an hour, roughly. Okay? Well, still, you have food preparers receiving between $9.25 and $11.50 per hour. How many of them? 25%. You have about 12% of food preparers receiving, relatively higher wage of between $11.50 and $14.50 per hour. You get the point. So even the narrowly defined occupational group as food preparers have their wages varying to a significant extent. And the question is why? Why do wages vary for the same job, right? So the answer that we have from this course so far is the answer that, well, maybe the variation in wages reflects the variation in business strategies and therefore the corresponding C&B strategies that different firms implement. But this answer is, well, first of all, it's incomplete, and second, which is even worse, it doesn't provide an answer to a more fundamental question. Why? What is the reason for paying different wages in order to promote, in order to prosecute different business and C&B strategies? Why do you need to pay different wages if you want to develop a competitive advantage as compared to your, as compared to the rest of the market? Okay, so wages differ even for the same job, and why? And for today's lecture and the lecture next week, we're going to try and answer this question more completely. So, there are several reasons why wages differ. Well, one reason we know, it's the business strategy. Okay, so, but there are several more reasons. First reason in my list is institutions. What are institutions? Institutions is loosely defined as regulations and organizations that promote these regulations. So you have legal regulations, you have trade unions, the institutional regulations, you have discrimination, which is hopefully not institutional, even though in many, many countries, many unfortunate countries in this world, discrimination is institutional, thankfully not in Germany. So what do institutions do in order to create differences in wages? Institutions effectively control the demand on the market, right? Institutions have an impact on market demand, and if there is a regulation that messes with the market demand, the equilibrium wage on this market, the actual wage on this market is not going to correspond to the equilibrium wage on this market, so that there will be either, you know, overemployment of people or more likely underemployment of people. Now, a given institution, a given set of regulations does not have an equally strong bite on all markets and in all occupations. That's why you have labor markets which are more regulated, so there's more institutional distortion on these markets, and markets that which are less regulated, so the wage is closer to the equilibrium homogeneous level for a given level of skill. Here are a couple of examples. This is a typical story of the minimum wage, what minimum wage does to the market, right? So you have labor demand, you have labor supply, you have the would-be equilibrium here, but here comes the law, and the law says the wage has to be at least so much, okay? Now, if the wage is so much, there will be so many vacancies that firms will create under the prescribed level of minimum wage, and there will be so many people willing to work under this minimum wage. Now, clearly, there's a difference between the number of people willing to work for this wage and the number of vacancies that these people can take. And there's a difference, right? There are more people willing to work for this wage than vacancies created. And the difference between the people willing to work at this wage and the jobs available for these people is, of course, the unemployment. So unemployment, in theory, is a consequence of minimum wage, but our course is compensation and benefits, right? So it's not about people who are unfortunately unemployed. It's about people who are employed. And for the people who are employed, there are also consequences. The people who are employed are going to enjoy the minimum wage, which is above the equilibrium, right? And on different markets, as I said, the minimum wage would have a different bite. So in some markets, there's no minimum wage. On other markets, there is a minimum wage. And so that creates differences in wage levels. Now, within the same economy, you could also think about minimum wage reducing the differences in wages, because typically minimum wage applies to a greater extent to low-skill, low-wage occupations, such as food preparers, for instance. And, you know, yes, there is a minimum wage, but it does not apply to my wage, because my wage is anyway above the minimum wage. So I don't care about minimum wage as far as my employment is concerned. The food preparers do care about minimum wage. So in the absence of minimum wage, the difference between my wage and the wage of a food preparer would be larger than under the minimum wage. So the direction, so the institutions and regulations, they don't always increase the differences in wages. Sometimes institutions and regulations can actually reduce the differences in wages. But all the more, the institutions are obviously an important factor affecting wages beyond the simple supply and demand story. Now, you may, just the last thing I have to say about the minimum wage, you may recall from more advanced labor economics course, well, still undergraduate level, you may recall that in the case of monopsony, the minimum wage actually increases welfare. So I don't want to leave an impression that I am always necessarily against the minimum wage. Yes, in a very simple story, the minimum wage creates unemployment, which is bad, which is welfare reducing. You have the deadweight loss. All right. But in the case of monopsony, the minimum wage may actually be welfare increasing. You may recall it from a proper labor economics course that you took in the past. Here is monopsony. Monopsony is when there's only one buyer on the market. So monopoly is when there's is when there's only one seller. Monopsony is when there's only one buyer. So imagine a little town where there's only one employer who therefore controls the labor demand, and in that case it's welfare improving to have a certain level of minimum wage so as to reduce the rent that the monopsonist. Monopsony. Right. Okay. So here's another example. The role of institutions in shaping wages on an otherwise competitive labor market. This is an example of supply restrictions. German citizens can work in Switzerland with almost no restrictions, right? I think it's fairly easy. Maybe you need to have some kind of work permit, but I think it's fairly easy because I see lots of people living in my house in Radolfzell who travel to Switzerland to work every day, right? So it's okay. So let's say there are no restrictions. If you're a German citizen, you can come to Switzerland. So you have in Switzerland the wages are higher than in Germany, so there will be a supply of workers from Germany willing to work in Switzerland, and the wage will be close to equilibrium in Switzerland. Now suppose there is a referendum in Switzerland and they decide to limit the supply of German workers to Switzerland. Let's say they will say, okay, we're not European Union, and therefore we introduce very tough visas and permits for whoever wants to work in Switzerland. What's going to happen is the supply of labor is going to greatly reduce. And if the requirements, if the restrictions are extremely tough so that no one else other than Swiss citizens can work in Switzerland, what's going to happen is that the supply of labor will become totally inelastic and will be equal to the number of working population in Switzerland. Okay? What's going to happen is the new market equilibrium is going to be here, right? So there will be that many people working at a wage which is higher than previously observed equilibrium wage, right? So another example is, more realistic, right? Switzerland is never going to introduce anything of this kind. Another example is public notaries. Notaries, you know what I'm talking about? It's the people who authorize who read through the wills, and if you want to buy a house, then they will be there making the contract and charging you 1.5% of the sale price of the house, which I think is an extortion, right? So the notaries are one of the richest employees in Germany. They are officially public sector employees, but they are sort of self-employed because everybody has their own office and the secretary, etc. So public notaries in Germany is one of the highest paid people I've ever met in my life. Okay, so why? Because the supply of public notaries is limited, right? You know, you can't just, if you want to become a public notary, it's very, very difficult. It's not like the supply of, I don't know, sales managers or supply of IT specialists who, you know, whoever can count can actually, you know, try and become an IT specialist or a sales operative. With notaries, it's very different. With notaries, there are quotas and there can only be a certain number of public notaries within a certain geographical area. Okay. Now, given the demand for notary services and the limited supply of notaries, the price of notary services is going to be way higher than the equilibrium. Now, if you compare public notaries with, let's say, property lawyers whose skill set is, even though not exactly the same, but very similar to the skill set of public notaries, you'll see that property lawyers earn less. Property lawyers are still rich people, don't get me wrong, but notaries earn more. Why? Because the supply of notaries is regulated, whereas the supply of lawyers is less regulated. It's a little bit regulated. You still need to have the exam, and you need to be registered with various professional associations, but it's less difficult than in the case of notaries. So when you have regulated and non-regulated professions, wages will differ for no good reason other than regulations. And, you know, it could be an interesting, but I would say extremely challenging topic to try and explain why you need the regulation of notaries. So, now, the second reason why wages differ, it has to do with the notion of compensating wage differential. You know what compensating wage differential is? I'm sure you know it from your basic labor economics course or even microeconomics course. So here's the story, which is, I think, quite abundantly illustrated by this provocative picture. So the toothbrush says, "Sometimes I feel that I have the worst job in the world." And the toilet paper says, "Ah, yeah, okay, you bet." Right? So you have two agents whose purpose, whose job is not exactly identical, but, you know, similar. So both these agents are, let's define their occupational group as personal hygiene services, okay? And yet, the pleasantness of the job of a toothbrush is different from the pleasantness of the job of a toilet roll, right? So, when jobs are unpleasant or dangerous or both, then the hedonic costs of bearing the, you know, unpleasantness of the job or riskiness of the job, it becomes part of the wage, right? So the jobs, even though they're equally skilled, they may well vary in terms of how pleasant they are. And this variation will become part of the wage. Examples? Well, you're invited to think of examples along the lines of pleasantness or riskiness of different, quite related jobs. The example that I had in the slides is an example from a small region in the United States called Pittsylvania, not Pennsylvania, which is a big state. But it's a county, it's a region within the state called Pittsylvania. I never heard about it before I went out to learn about compensating wage differentials. So it's not a very prosperous region in the United States. The average household income is just under $40,000 per year, which is poor. But if you look, what Pennsylvania is sort of famous for is uranium mines. So there are lots of mines in that state. And the miners who work in uranium mines earn on average, in a very poor county of Pennsylvania, they earn on average $65,000. So either uranium miners are like public notaries whose supply is limited, or they possess exceptionally high and rare skill set, which needs to be rewarded with high wages, or their job, while not very sophisticated and not regulated, is so difficult, unpleasant, and risky that the costs of difficulty, unpleasantness, and riskiness of the job must be incorporated into the wage and must become what's known as compensating wage differential. Now, of these three possibilities, the latter seems more probable. Right? The supply of uranium miners is not regulated. The skill set required to be a uranium miner is not particularly exceptional. Right? Yet, these people earn a lot of money, relatively a lot of money. Why? Well, because mining uranium is hazardous, and these health costs need to be offset by compensating wage differential. So far, so good? So this is one of the reasons why wages differ. Now, another reason, and that brings us to closer to the issue of signaling and screening, which is going to be the next chapter in this lecture. Another reason is that unlike in the theory of competitive labor markets, the basic theory of competitive labor markets with which we started this lecture, the real world is characterized quite fundamentally, in quite fundamental way, by information asymmetry. Now, what is information asymmetry? Information asymmetry is a situation in which different agents have different bits of information, but no one has all the information relevant to make a transaction or to make a decision. So, an example, we sign an employment contract. You are the principal, I am the agent, you hire me, I am the agent to do the work. What is the total amount of information required to make this transaction by way of competitive market? Remember the lecture slides on competitive markets. All firms and workers have perfect information about jobs, skills, and wages. So you should have perfect information about how productive I am. Right? So you should know how productive I am. Do you have this information? I don't think so. Because if you ask Nick, how productive are you? Of course, I'll say I'm extremely productive. Just as a side note, I sit in graduate school selection committees at various universities, and we receive applications for doctoral programs from all over the world. And for some reason, there are a lot of applications from the Middle East, Middle Eastern countries, and Iran in particular. So in many, many applications, in the majority of applications that I receive from people from there, they say, I belong to the top 0.005 or 7 or 8% in terms of entrance exams for mathematics entrance exams in Iran. When I was younger, I thought, wow, it's a genius. But then I had another 100 of people saying they belong to the top 0.5% of the distribution, and another 100 people, and another 100 people. So right now I'm just throwing this away. I'm just deleting this information from the file. Right? So when you rely on the knowledge of the agent himself about how productive this agent is, this knowledge is plagued by the agency problem. The agent will have all the incentive to say, I'm super genius, right? There's no way of telling. So one important piece of information to carry out a market transaction, which is to employ me to do a certain job, my productivity is not available to the principal who decides on the level of wage to offer to me. That's clearly information asymmetry. Now, I should also, as a worker, I should know the technology parameter. I should know the production function. I should know about the process and financial parameters of the process through which my effort translates into the profit for the principal. Because not only the principal needs to negotiate with me, I also need to negotiate with the principal. And in order to negotiate, we need to know each other's balances, right? That information is also not immediately observed. So, labor market is characterized by information asymmetry. What are the consequences of information asymmetry? Well, the consequences of one big consequence of information asymmetry is inefficiency of market transactions. Have you heard of the term efficiency in economics? Efficiency, what it means? Have you heard of the term Pareto efficiency? Have you heard of the term welfare? Right? So, highest possible efficiency corresponds to the maximum welfare. The possible maximum welfare is typically not achieved in market transactions. So either you have too little effort invested or too high wage paid to notaries, or, right? So the consequence of information asymmetry is efficiency loss and welfare loss. One example. So let's just sort of develop on the example that I gave. So I am an applicant for a job, and the naive principal, like I was some years ago, naive principal asks me, how productive are you? What is your percentage in the entrance exam, on the maths entrance exam? What would be my answer? 0.00, I can't say zero because it become too blatant. Let's say 0.00658, you know, to have it kind of sort of spurious precision. So how are we going to verify this? Right? So the principal, a naive principal, will offer me a super high wage corresponding to my exceptionally high achievements in mathematics. And that's going to be one of the worst investments that the principal will ever make. The principal is not naive. Another principal is not naive. Another principal will anticipate this. And learning from the lessons of his more naive colleague and competitor, this principal will offer me a lower wage. But then at the end of the day, in the absence of information about productivity levels, of how productive people are, everybody would get more or less the same going market wage. And in economics and microeconomics, this situation is called pooling equilibrium, if you remember. Right? Now, pooling equilibrium is inefficient. Why is it not efficient? Because some, especially high productivity types of people, will not be working at the going wage in the pooling equilibrium. So you will have underemployment and underproduction. Now, what is the way out of the pooling equilibrium, of the inefficiencies brought in by pooling equilibrium? The principal may wish to try and learn something about the productivity of the agent. And the measures that principals take in order to learn more about the productivity of the agent, all these various measures are summarized by the term screening. So when you say screening, you refer to the ways employers, firms, principals take in order to learn how productive you are really. You know, just forget this stupid entrance maths exam, which there's no way of verifying. Let's try to assess how productive you are. How do we do this? As I said, various ways. Some of them we will consider in this lecture. One obvious way is to have a probation period, for instance. You know, you employ people not forever, but let's say for 3 months, probezeit. And during this probation period, you see how productive this person is, and you update your information about this person's productivity. You can also have assessment, lots of tests. Have you heard of assessment centers? Of course, you know, all these big companies where everybody's dreaming of working, they have huge big assessment centers where people are invited for 2-3 days to do individual assessments, team assessments, this assessment, that assessment. I never made it there. I sent hundreds of applications to P&Gs and Ernst & Young's. No one will ever bother at inviting me to an assessment center, but I have known more successful people in job applications. Now, so most of the measures that firms take to screen their workers, they are expensive, right? They bring some costs. You need to build an assessment center. You need to invest time in observing this particular new worker during their probezeit. You need to spend time and effort doing interviews, etc., etc. Right? Now, are these costs productive? Yes, they are productive, because with some probability higher than chance, they allow firms to identify the high productivity workers and offer them wages that will make employment in those firms attractive. Okay? Now, are these costs, you know, is the separating equilibrium in the presence of screening, is this efficient? Well, it's a little bit more efficient than pooling equilibrium, but it's not fully efficient. Why not? Well, an efficient market allocation would maximize the sum of the welfare of the firm and the welfare of the workers. So under the efficient market equilibrium, you would have the firm's profit plus workers' wages at a maximum. Okay? Now, what you have in reality in the presence of screening is you have firm's profits plus workers' wages minus the costs of screening at the maximum. And of course, the allocation that maximizes profits plus wages minus costs of screening is not efficient because of the presence of the screening costs. Right? So Do we solve the efficiency problem by screening? Yes, we do, but we never solve it completely because screening is costly and screening costs are not welfare enhancing. Why? Because they don't make people more productive. People's productivity is fixed and is there to be learned. We pay these costs in order to learn this productivity, but it has nothing to do with affecting the productivity of the workers who we screen. Now, the workers are not ignorant to the firms screening the workers, and the workers can choose to help firms screen them. Right? Of course, this help will be done strategically, and the workers will signal their ability by acquiring certain characteristics, by demonstrating certain behaviors which in their mind correspond to the high productivity type of person. So when that student who wrote in their graduate school application that I belong to the top 0.0 whatever percent of maths entrance exams in Iran, what was he or she thinking? They were thinking about signaling how super intelligent and productive they are. Okay, so that's an example of signaling activity. It's not a very good example of signaling activity. It's actually one of the relatively silly types of signaling activity. Why? Because it's cheap talk. Have you heard of the term cheap talk? It's cheap talk, you know? I can say I'm an economics Nobel Prize winner. Yeah? To try and impress you. Of course, it's very easy to verify that I'm not an economics Nobel Prize winner. Right? So I can keep saying either explicitly or, you know, by way of signaling that I am a very, very high productivity type. But as long as it's me who says this, it's cheap talk because it's totally you know, vulnerable to the obvious agency problem between the principal and the agent. So what's the way out? One way out, of course, is verification, and that has to do with screening. So we've talked about it. Another way out of it is to do signaling in a clever way, is to demonstrate types of behavior and characteristics which could be acquired, which should be acquired only to the people of a certain productivity type. We will do a tutorial on screening and signaling next week, so there we will be able to go through these models in greater detail, so don't worry if it's too abstract right now. So one classical example is education. Why it's a good signal? Well, because if you are really intelligent and productive, education is cheaper for you in terms of, you know, total costs of having it, so you will acquire more education. And if you're not so intelligent, you will acquire less education because it's so expensive for you, right? So of course there are financial costs of education, and that creates an imperfection in this signal. No signal is perfect, yeah. But by acquiring education, people are able to signal their productivity type to the workers, and this signal is no longer cheap talk. Why not? Because education is objectively expensive, and it is more expensive for the less smart people. That's why it works. Well, you don't know, but you know that on average, more educated people are smarter. Yeah. On average, not in every individual case. So there's no guarantee that you will make the right decision in each individual case. But there is a higher probability that you will make the right decision when you hire lots of people with more education. That's one thing I have to say in response to your question. And the second thing I have to say in response to your question is, in a sense, it doesn't really matter very much whether you get more education because you're rich or whether you get more education because you're smart. Because, you know, the human capital theory implies, very influential theory in economics, right? The human capital theory implies that the more years you spend at school, the more productive you become. So you could be, you know, not a very smart guy from a very rich family and do a PhD at Oxford, right? Or you could be a very smart kid from a very poor family and do a bachelor degree at another university. In both cases, spending time at university will increase your productivity. So to the extent to which education increases your productivity, it doesn't matter how it's financed. Now, having said that, the very point of signaling, as we will learn in the tutorial, the very point of signaling is that signaling is inefficient, is not welfare in maximizing. Why not? Because the costs of signaling are higher than the productivity benefits that signaling creates. In a sense that your costs of acquiring education are higher than the implied productivity gains from acquiring education. But the productivity benefits from acquiring education are still not zero in the general situation. As I said, wait till the tutorial to learn more about it. Now, so there's signaling and screening. And signaling is mostly done by workers. Screening is mostly done by firms, but not always. Workers also screen firms to try and choose the firms which are best for them. And firms also try to signal their type to the workers when firms want to hire the workers who they think would fit better to their ideal type of workers given their chosen business strategy. So signaling and screening is not done exclusively by workers and firms respectively. It's a more complicated situation. Now, here is an example of, we've gone through the examples of signaling and screening by workers and firms. Here is an example of signaling activities that firms pursue in order to attract the workers who they would like to attract. So here are two firms which offer the same value, by and large, roughly the same value of their total compensation package. So what is their total cash compensation package? It consists of the base salary plus benefits plus bonus plus incentive pay, right? What you see is that the total is the same, but the structure of the compensation package is different. And it's different in a way that signals the type of the firm to the workers. So this company B offers a total compensation package where incentive pay, the stock options, and another element of incentive pay, the bonus, are much more prominent. They make up almost 20% of the total value of the compensation package. Whereas company A, there pays neither bonus nor option. The total size of compensation package is the same, the structure is different. How should the workers read these differences, and should the workers take these differences into account? Well, what firm B tries to signal by designing its compensation package in such a way is that it wants people who like material incentives. And who are the people who like material incentives? Well, these are the people with not very strong risk aversion, the people who are prepared to take calculated financial risks, because of course if you have incentive pay then you expose people to risk. Company B seems to want hardworking people because incentives are more attractive for hardworking people. We will learn why it's the case precisely mathematically in the next lecture. So if you are a worker with low-ish risk attitude and high willingness to put in effort, which firm would you rather work in, firm A or firm B? Well, you would work rather in firm B. Why? Because there you can increase your wage by working harder through the vehicles of options and bonus. Whereas it doesn't really matter how hard you work, there's no bonus or options in the pay package offered by company A. So by designing compensation pay packages in a clever and strategic way, firms can signal their type to the workers and try to attract the worker types that they need most. Okay? So, now, Let's move on. So we've spoken about information asymmetry. There are also differences in CNB policies, which we've discussed already. Okay. So what we were talking about is that there are different business strategies. The CNB strategies have to fit the chosen business strategy. Now, a given CNB strategy reflects a trade-off between external competitiveness, is basically, you know, how much you pay in order to attract the right type of people for you. That's one part of the trade-off. The other part of the trade-off is internal alignment. You should make sure that within your organization you pay more senior people larger amounts of money. And the business strategy is the third element of the trade-off. The business strategy obviously has an impact on your HR strategy, on the type of people you want to acquire, and through this vehicle, on the design and value of compensation, of the total compensation and benefits package. So here is an illustration. Before we move on to the next slide, it's very important to mention that, well, firms, unlike in the basic labor market, competitive labor market model, where compensation and benefits are really the same, so there's no need to distinguish between compensation and benefits, it's all about cash. In reality, the different parts of the CNB package can mean different things to different people, and so firms can strategically design these packages to attract the right people, the people who they think is right for them. But there is also different job packages in reflecting the trade-offs between how attractive this job is, how convenient this job is, how appealing this job is, and how financially rewarding this job is. So this is a sort of background for the example that I'm going to give on this slide. I do apologize for the poor visibility. I hope it's better on the slides. If somebody reminds me to make these illustrations more visible, I will. I will just put them on different slides to make it more visible. Actually, it's not, you know, hugely important. What we see here is are the averages from employee survey. So all big firms, or most of big firms, run employee surveys regularly, let's say every year. And in these surveys, they ask employees about how satisfied they are with different aspects of their job. So not only with pay, also with the support from the company, satisfaction with how satisfied they are with personal relationships within with colleagues and subordinates, etc., and satisfaction with the work atmosphere. And it turns out that the same compensation and benefits package, which is very basic for this type of employees, I know because I've worked with this company, the same job, say cashier in a supermarket, has very different levels of appeal and satisfaction for different employees, right? So, for instance, if you look at satisfaction with pay is on the scale between 1 and 7, on average, is for cashiers is 2.5. So most of them are dissatisfied with pay. But if you look at the satisfaction with respect from colleagues and managers, is basically, you know, to translate it from the local languages, how satisfied you are with the internal psychological climate within your work, the satisfaction on the scale between 1 and 7 is 5.6, so they're very satisfied, right? So yes, you do have shitty wages, but you have plenty of satisfaction and good psychological climate within your organization. And that's a trade-off. Think about compensating wage differentials, right? So you could have a super highly paying job, where everybody is a competitor, an enemy to each other, bad atmosphere in the collective, but everybody's earning lots of money. That's one possible situation, and for some people it will be more appealing than to others. Here's another type of situation in which people are getting very low wages, but enjoy the work, enjoy the work a bit more. So different firms make different choices on this scale, which are influenced by the type of business strategy that they choose, and of course by technology. In this particular case, the philosophy is the following. It's a little bit like Whole Foods market example that we considered last lecture. The philosophy is the following. To run a supermarket, you need a strong sense of the team. You need a team, right? So individual efforts are not as productive individually as part of the team. So how do you encourage the team? You encourage the team by promoting the right values and the right psychological climate within the team. You know, you introduce, when you want to offer incentives, you make these incentives team incentives rather than individual incentives. When you think about employee management programs, you think about collective training programs, you think about group celebrations of New Year, of Christmas, of Easter, right? So you think about group activities and team building exercises, which of course are costly, and that reduces your ability to pay super high wages. Do you need to pay super high wages? Not really, because you don't want people who are all only into wages. You want people who appreciate the team spirit, because these are the type of people who you want to employ given your technology and business strategy. Does it make sense to you? Right. So think about whether you would be willing to work for next to zero wages in an excellent team. Yes or no? There's no right answer. Some people would, other people wouldn't. I wouldn't. But that just tells you how different people are, not only in terms of their productivity, but also in terms of their fit to the business strategy chosen by the firms, by different firms. Okay? So now, and there is moral hazard, which is a continuation of the information asymmetry story, which I just told you some time ago. The typical way to reduce moral hazard, typical way to align the interests of the principal and the agent is to introduce incentives. Why does it work? Because any incentive would align the interest, economic interests of the principal more closely with the economic interests of the agents. You can do it in various ways. It works, as we will learn next lecture. Next lecture, we will also learn why don't all firms practice incentive. There are very clear answers to this very big and interesting question. We will also have a separate lecture on how you evaluate performance with the purpose of incentivizing people. Very interesting topic, which has a lot to do with the different propensities of different firms for practicing incentive pay. But there is an issue of moral hazard. Workers want to work as little as possible. Firms want to exploit the workers as much as possible. There is an antagonism between the working class and the bourgeoisie. Incentives rather than revolution is a way out. So no revolution, incentives. Okay, so now, speaking about incentives, let us sort of have a go at the topic of incentives, which will receive a more detailed treatment, more deep treatment the next lecture. So what is incentive? I found this dictionary definition of incentives, and it's a very generic and I think very to the point definition. So if you want to motivate someone to do something, you have to offer them a thing that motivates someone to do something. A very generic definition, which of course is in great need of substantiation. So what is the someone? Someone is the agent. What is the something? Is the profit that the principal wants to earn? And what is the thing that motivates someone to do something? Is what the agent values, not necessarily money. Of course, most of the time it's money, but not necessarily. That motivates the agent to increase the principal's profit. The variety of arrangements that can, the variety of situations that fit these space holders in this very generic definition of incentives makes the topic of incentives very, very long and interesting one. So what's the most interesting about incentives? I am not sure what's the most interesting about incentives. I guess the most interesting about incentives is that you can't really incentivize what you want the agent to do. What do you want the agent to do? You want the agent to work hard. So, according to the definition of incentives, what you should do then is you should measure the employee's, the agent's effort, and say the more effort you put in, the more money I will give you. Okay? Problem is, the effort is not observed. This, remember, we are in the world of information asymmetry. Things are not observed. So, you have to incentivize not effort, which is what you want, but you have to incentivize a certain observable manifestation of effort, which is not necessarily what you want. Remember this example of with rats in Vietnam in the beginning of 20th century. The colonizers, the French administration, wanted the local people to put in effort in the direction of killing rats. Okay? So their measure of the effort of killing rats could be the number of rats that they kill. But they chose not to use this measure for incentive purposes. What they rather chose is to use rat tails. The logic was sound. You know, every rat has a tail, and the rat is reluctant to part with its tail. So you will only persuade the tail to part with the rat to part with its tail by killing it. So that was the logic. The locals found a way around it, and that made incentives a huge mess. So that I regard, you know, a very nice example which illustrates, I think, what is the most interesting about incentives, that you cannot incentivize precisely what you want. You have to incentivize a manifestation of what you want. And there's a difference. And these differences can be strategically exploited and is strategically exploited by the agents at the principal's expense. So, to cut the long story short, we need proxies for effort. We need manifestations of effort or proxies for effort. And there are different proxies for effort. And because there are different proxies for effort, the different ways of measuring effort, we will also have a lecture on performance measurement. There are different ways in which you can administer incentives. So, one proxy for effort is a very simple proxy, is shirking. You know what shirking is? Not working hard enough. So you can work hard or you can shirk. They are two opposite things, right? So, I come to work. I need to work on the lecture on incentives. Instead, I check my emails, I read news, I watch my favorite YouTube channel, I eat something, drink something, talk to my friends on the phone, so I shirk. Okay? Now, shirking is only detected when you monitor people. So what you can do is you can put video cameras in my office. That, of course, is not accessible. I will sue the hell out of my employer for doing so. And people at Aldi have done so about 10 years ago. So you have to introduce some non-invasive monitoring techniques, which are, of course, less precise. So with some certain non-zero probability, your shirking will be detected if you shirk. And that creates a danger, that creates an incentive for you to shirk less than you otherwise would. Now, to implement this very basic incentive scheme, what is required is the efficiency wage. It's a wage which is above the market equilibrium, and it's above the market equilibrium not because your business strategy is different, that's a different story. It's above the market equilibrium not because of the minimum wage or regulation, it's above the perfect competitive market equilibrium on a perfect competitive labor market for no other reason other than create a difference between the efficiency wage and the market wage, which the worker would have lost upon being fired for shirking. Now, you can also use actual performance for incentives, like sales that you generate, for instance, or customer service that you generate, which will be the topic for the next lecture. Now let's look at the efficiency wage, and let's look at the very simple model of efficiency wage. The classical paper, of course, is the Akerlof Quarterly Journal of Economics paper on the efficiency wage, where a more complete mathematical treatment is given to this. But let's look at the very, very basic model of efficiency wage, because I think that's more or less sort of sufficient for the purposes of this course. So no incentives in the form of performance-related pay. You have a fixed wage, W, and you can either work or shirk. It's a 0-1 decision. Okay, so when you work, it's unpleasant for you, you bear a cost, C, and when you shirk, you enjoy yourself, so there's no cost of effort. So far, so easy. Now, the firm cannot have a video camera always in your office, so it cannot always detect whether you work or shirk. Rather, it uses some monitoring technique with probability P, fraction P of all the time, will tell you whether the worker is working or shirking. So for example, you sit in your office, there's no camera, but let's say once every, you know, let's say 3 times per day, my boss will enter my office without knocking on the door and will be able to see whether I work or shirk. So that gives you the probability of being detected working or shirking. And that probability is a P. Now, if my boss enters my office and sees me shirking, I'm fired. I'm fired, but because the market is super competitive and no regulations, nothing, I am hired by another firm that pays an equilibrium wage W0, so which is below the wage W that I receive now. So I'm a professor earning what I regard a very good wage. If I am found shirking, I'm fired, and my next employer will probably be some kind of Fachhochschule, which will offer me a much lower wage than university. So far, so realistic, actually, yeah? Even though it's a very simple model. Now, what are my benefits from working? My benefits from working is the wage that I receive minus the costs of effort, because remember, this is conditional on me working. What are my benefits from shirking? That's where the situation becomes a little bit more interesting. With probability P, I am fired and go to Fachhochschule and earning W0 there. With probability 1 minus P, I'm not caught, even though I'm shirking, and the university will continue paying me the wage W, the high wage W. Okay? So, in what situation will I work rather than shirk? I will only work if my net wage from working is at least as high as my net wage from shirking. Now, when you solve this inequality in terms of its parameters, you will find the condition for working rather than shirking. And this condition is very, very intuitive, very, very simple. So, on the right-hand side here, you have the costs of effort. And the costs of effort, by definition, are the marginal cost of working as compared to shirking. So if you shirk and want to start working, you will pay an additional cost C. What is this? This is the marginal benefit from working. What is the marginal benefit from working? The marginal benefit from working, of course, is equal to the wage differential between the efficiency wage and the market, the competitive wage, the alternative wage, multiplied by the probability that you're actually going to lose this, which is P, which is monitoring intensity. So it's nothing really except the simple marginal benefit equal marginal cost logic with which you can solve majority of economics problems. Marginal benefit from working has to be at least as large as the marginal cost of working for the worker to work. Okay. Now, So let's look at this condition in greater detail and try to, you know, think about what it implies for business practice. Okay, the maths, as you can see, is extremely simple. The story around this maths is probably a little bit more interesting. So now, what should the firm do Should the firm choose efficiency wage or should it not choose efficiency wage, right? There are costs and benefits for the firm as well. The benefits for the firm, of course, is the higher output that the worker creates. The costs for the firm are the costs of having to pay higher than market wage and the costs of running this monitoring technology that with probability P will detect worker whether the worker is working or shirking. Now, so what should the firm choose? What is the firm's decision parameters? The firm's decision variables are the monitoring technology. It chooses how intensely to monitor the worker, and it chooses the wage that the firm should pay to the worker. Okay? So, and the firm will choose this combination in such a way that will maximize the firm's profit, which is the output net of the total costs, which is the cost of wage plus the costs of monitoring. And this condition for the worker to work dictates the optimal choice, is one of the elements of the optimal, is one of the conditions for the optimal choice of the W and P. In particular, if you have a super good monitoring technology that determines, that detects shirking with very high productivity, what should be the wage that you will offer? Suppose the probability is equal to 1. Suppose you have a super good monitoring technology. With probability 1, it will detect shirking if shirking is taking place. What should be the wage that you should offer to the worker? It should be W0 plus C. So it should be your market opportunity wage plus the costs of effort if you want to work hard, right? Because if you look here, yeah, it's sort of minimum wage. If you look here, P is equal to 1, and then the condition becomes the wage differential equal to the extra costs of effort. Okay? Now, suppose your monitoring technology is actually not that perfect. Suppose it only can determine shirking with, let's say, probability, 20%. Okay? Now, if P is equal to 20%, then in order for this condition to still satisfy, you're going to have to offer a lot larger wage if you still want the worker to work hard. So the intensity of monitoring and the amount of the wage that you offer to workers to make them work high are substitutes in the sense that you either make sure you monitor like hell, or if you can't monitor like hell, you have to make sure that you pay very well. Now, look at the cashiers, the cash till operators in supermarkets. It's a very, very tough work. I tried to apply for it when I was a student. I wasn't selected. I didn't pass the maths test. But I know it's very, very tough. But do they earn lots of money? No, they earn next to minimum wage. Why? There's no need to pay them efficiency wage because they are observed, their effort is observed. You know, they work in an open room full of customers, and the shop manager and various shop detectives are somewhere there, and there are lots of video cameras here and there, so you can monitor these cash deal operators very, very effectively, and you can detect with very, very high probability whether they work or shirk, so you don't need to pay them very high wages. Now, on the other hand, you need to pay very high wage to me, because monitoring my whether I work or shirk is much more expensive. Much more difficult. How do you decide whether I work or shirk? You actually need to, well, there's no way you will install a video camera in my office, right? So you need to devise all sorts of procedures to determine how hard I work, whether I work or shirk, which require specialist knowledge, which require people to understand what I'm doing, and that requires, of course, hiring a consultant whose fee will also be pretty high. Right? So you can't monitor whether Nick works or shirks with very high precision, and therefore what you should do is you should offer Nick a very high wage in order to make him work hard. Now, let's see whether this logic holds water. It does. It's one of the sort of basic predictions of the efficiency wage theory. Let me illustrate this prediction with the data from Canadian province of Ontario, that's where Toronto is, it's the biggest economy of Canada. So this is the data from a government organization called Pay Equity, and they monitor wages for men and women. They actually have one of their mandates is to make sure there's gender equality in wages. Gender equality in wages is also a topic that we will consider later on in this course. These are average wages for men and women. The green bar is women, the yellow bar is men, in firms of different size. So I'm just took this picture from the website. I'm not interested in gender equality in this lecture. What I am interested is I am interested in wage differences between firms of different size. What you see, small firms, less than 20 employees, the wage is about $18 per hour on average in small firms. Okay? Look at large firms, over 500 employees. The average wage is somewhere around $26-$27 per hour. So we're talking about just under $10 per hour difference in wages paid by large firms and small firms. Question is why? Well, of course, there are various reasons. Large firms are more productive. Large firms are are more likely to be monopolist or oligopoly in their local markets, so they have higher profits and they can share some of these profits with employees. That is all true, right? But another reason why wages differ between firm size is the reason which has to do with the topic of efficiency wage of this lecture, namely, try to monitor workers in large firms. It's very, very difficult. Right? In supermarkets, supermarket is a super small firm. I mean, supermarkets as networks of supermarkets are medium to large size firms, but a particular supermarket is like a small firm. There are maybe a total of 20 employees working there, right? And most of them work part-time. So at any given point in time, you'd have maybe, let's say, 10 employees on the shopping floor. You can monitor these people very easily. And if you can monitor them very easily, there's no need to pay them high wages. Now, if you have a very, very large firm, monitoring employees in a very, very large firm is very hard. And so you have to offer them an efficiency wage in order to compensate for the lower P in larger firms. Do you follow my logic? See, does it make sense to you, right? So efficiency wage works. It's not only a sound logical argument, it actually also, evidence consistent with the efficiency wage theory is observed in the data. Let's discuss this. The point was made that it may be that for larger firms, the marginal costs of monitoring technology are lower. To think about an example, suppose, if you want to do monitoring, you have to pay some fixed costs to install the infrastructure, and then you would pay some operational costs. And in this case, if you want to spread this cost over a larger scale of operation, the total cost will be smaller. So the marginal costs are going to be the same, actually, because the marginal cost is, the fixed costs don't play a role. But the average cost of monitoring may be lower in bigger firms. Is that your point?
Yeah.
Right. Now, if the average costs of monitoring are lower in bigger firms, then bigger firms should offer lower wages to be consistent with the theory. The fact is that bigger firms offer higher wages, which may be explained by other reasons. Is that the logic, right?
Yeah.
It's logically possible, right? It's logically possible. And the conclusion from this point would be that this illustration alone is not strong enough evidence for the efficiency wage. I agree. Good point. There is another piece of evidence for efficiency wage. Larry Summers wrote a paper in the Journal of Labor Economics, in 1988. The title is "Did Henry Ford Pay Efficiency Wages?" You can check it out. Henry Ford was an example from the introductory lecture. Remember? Everybody was paying $2 per day, he paid $5 per day. Why? to keep the turnover low and make sure the workers don't shirk. So this table itself is not strong enough evidence for efficiency wage for the reason that you've just outlined. And thanks for your contribution. There is another piece of evidence that they can offer for efficiency wage that they work. Now, to get back to your, you know, idea that in larger firms the average cost of monitoring may be lower. Depends on monitoring technology. If we're talking about video cameras installed in, you know, individual cubicles, then that may be the case. But if we're talking about, there is a theory in management, basically the span of control. You heard of it? Span of control. So if you do monitoring, if you delegate the responsibility to do monitoring to managers, right? So you don't have video cameras. You say, managers, you have to monitor the whether your employees are shirking or working. Then you have a problem in bigger organizations because given the fixed span of control, you necessarily have lower ability to monitor all people within this organization by the managers. So it's... let me think about it. Let me think about whether your initial argument is strong enough. Let me try to attack it, but I need more time. Yeah. Okay, thanks. All right, so good point. Now, let's move on to, we have a few minutes left. Let's see how far we can go. If we don't go that far, then we will resume next lecture, and you can also read the slides. So let's put together the efficiency wage and screening, and we can continue with this during the tutorial on the 23rd of May. So efficiency wage and screening. We said just now that either you have a very precise monitoring technology and then you don't have to pay very high wages to incentivize people, or when you can't have a precise monitoring technology, you've got to pay higher wages to people in order to still, make sure that they work rather than shirk. So this argument have gone down fairly well, at least on the logical side of it. Okay, so, but there is another, other than wages, other than the W and P decision variables that the firms can manipulate with, there is a third variable, which is a worker characteristic and therefore in the basic version of the model is just a parameter that you cannot influence. But if you screen the workers, you can also indirectly affect this guy. So if you screen the workers and if you have a screening technique which allows you to identify with probability larger than chance a hardworking individuals, then the trade-off between the intensity of monitoring and the wage that you're paying will change. Namely, suppose you have a wonderful screening technology that allows you to identify high-ability workers. High-ability workers have a low C, and therefore, all else equal, high-ability workers, they don't need as high wages to make them work hard. Okay? So you can increase profit not only by monitoring more or paying high wages, you can also increase profit by selecting people with the lower costs of effort for whom this condition will be more likely to hold. Now, screening is not cheap. Screening is not free. Screening is a technology which has costs, just like monitoring technology. And during the tutorial, we will go through one example of screening technology called utility analysis and do a few exercises to illustrate the workings of this screening technology. So let's finish the lecture for today. I'll see you on the 23rd for the lecture on incentives and tutorial on the screening, signaling, and utility analysis. Thank you.